Good morning. This is Tracy Hales-Vass with Right on Four Corners on KSJE 90.9 FM in Farmington, New Mexico. Today, I'm talking with Christine Hemp about her memoir, Wild Ride Home, Love, Loss, and a Little White Horse, a family memoir. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning, Tracy.
How are you doing up in Washington State?
Pretty well. We're doing pretty well. We're getting a little warmer weather, and we're all on lockdown, everything's blooming. So that's a good sign.
It is. Springtime is a good time to be in quarantine, I guess.
Yeah, it seems to have helped things a lot.
Right.
And I'm lucky. We live right by the beach, and
nice.
I can ride my horse Buddy around in the forest.
Oh.
So I at least have a little more freedom than some people in cities.
Right.
So I'm very grateful for that.
Good. I got to know Buddy pretty well, as I did get to know you really well.
Yeah.
Reading your memoir is like stepping into your life for a little while.
Thank you. I'm glad.
Yeah. I mean, it was written in a way such that it's very readable, but it's very personal, too. So you definitely have exposed yourself to the world through this.
It's been an interesting experience to do that. And some people have asked me, well, how did that feel? And, you know, now that it's going out in the world, it's been a long time getting born, this memoir. So I've had a lot of distance on a lot of the parts of it, and I really do believe that helps.
Right.
Because then it becomes not just, you know, telling one about one's life. I mean, of course, every memoirist wants to be an artist, and I think that the point is to serve the story, and then the story takes over so that you're not thinking, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. And by the time it's done, it's shaped in a way that, at least for me, I was not afraid to put it in the world because it's true. It's the story I needed to tell, which I finally found. And it feels really great to let it go now.
You said just now that you had to find the story. I think that's the problem with a lot of memoirs, that there's no real point to it.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a story here. And I like the way you framed it around the little white horse Buddy.
Yeah, you know, Vivian Gornick, the memoirist, talks about, she has that really wonderful book called The Situation Versus the Story.
Right.
And we all have situations in our lives. You know, things happen to all of us. I mean, no one gets through this life without things happening, whether traumatic or wonderful or what have you. But the story is the thing we have to find. And it took me a long time because I've been writing this for, you know, a decade and more. And so I was finding the things that were actually connecting. But it wasn't until I realized, you know, I didn't know how to put it all together. And it was Buddy who, he's given me so many things, but he actually gave me the structure because I was looking, I didn't know quite what to do with it.
Right.
After these events had kept coming and I had to accommodate new events in my life, which is the weird thing about memoir, because you have to keep changing the time frame. Like, how much do you, you have to stop somewhere, right?
Where does it end?
So,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the cool thing, too, is that you can end in the time period and then you move beyond your story. You keep living. It isn't going to be, it doesn't have to identify your whole life, but I'll never forget one of my colleagues at Iowa. We used to write together after we taught our couple weeks at the festival in Iowa. We teach every year, and I brought my manuscript, and I said, I'm just limp. All I really, and Buddy had just come into my life in that last year, and I said, all I want to do is write about Buddy, and she just raised her left eyebrow, and I realized that Buddy could be a way to tell the story.
And it works. It works really
well. Thank
you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, Buddy is a very special creature in himself.
He's very special mm-hmm. and continues to be. People ask me about him, but he didn't stop with the end of this book. I mean, we have new things we're discovering all the time together, which is such a pleasure. It's like any relationship that grows.
Yeah, I really like that. I like that he's just has so much personality and is just walks through the pages of the book all the way.
Great. Well, I chose a little passage from the very beginning when we're first in a lesson with Ken.
Oh, yes.
Do you think that would be a good thing to read?
I do. Why don't you do that now for us?
Yeah, I'll just, it sort of sets the scene for who Buddy is. And it was early on in our relationship, so he was new. So I'd come to the fairgrounds here in my town. I live in a little seaside town in Washington State called Port Townsend. Anyway, I'd come to the fairgrounds for this horse clinic, and I hadn't been to any horse thing since I was a teenager, so I was kind of nervous, and I rode Buddy in bareback and all that, because I didn't know what to expect, but a friend had told me how wonderful this horseman was. Mm. So I'll just start in the place where I just met Ken, and I just met Ken, this horseman, and other horse people are around with their horses, and he's doing clinic with each one of us separately. But he says, "How long have you had him?" "Oh, actually, he's not my horse. He belongs to my neighbor, Fred," I admit to Ken. "But I've been spending time with him for about a year now." How could I recount in a few sentences how Buddy had come into my life? My mother would have said, "Draw the veil." I was not going to drop the word cancer into this bluebird of the day. Instead of explaining, I blurt out something I never expected to say out loud. "But I hope that he might be someday if my husband and I can afford to buy him." Of course, that day would exist only on a planet where our bank account gushed with fountains of extra cash. But I do not say this to Ken. After lunch, I asked if I should get the bridle. "Oh, no," Ken says. "Let's just see what he's up to." See, Buddy is, interrupt here to say, Buddy's loose in the arena at lunchtime. Mm-hmm. Ken grinds his cigarette in the dirt, tosses it into the trash bin, and picks up a dressage whip leaning against the fence. I can't imagine what Ken might do with Buddy without a halter or bridle, but he motions me into the arena and closes the gate. Ken makes a clucking sound. And Buddy's head flies up, a piece of grass hanging out of his mouth like a cigarette. When Ken holds out his hand, Buddy takes off in a floating gallop, swinging his head as he whooshes past us, close but just out of reach. "Now he's being rude," Ken says, without a trace of impatience or anger. "You little shit," Ken waves his arm at Buddy, who wags his head just a few feet from Ken. "You think you're going to bite me, do you?" Buddy faints left and gallops around again, snorting fiercely, nostrils flaring. Ken snaps the 3-foot whip against his leg, forcing Buddy to turn in the opposite direction, his mane flying, showing us he's king of the sky. But then Buddy spots something moving outside of the arena, and he dodges and bolts past Ken. "He's afraid now, see," Ken says. Buddy gallops full out. The whites of his eyes are like moons. He's scared himself. If we're not careful, he'll lose his head. I know horses are flight animals, and everything that frightens them is connected to prey behavior. The reason horses survived at all millions of years before humans was their ability to escape predators. Clearly, Buddy is wired for flight. When he gallops back, Ken sends him to the other direction. Buddy tosses his head, blows his nostrils, and sidesteps like a gymnast. But this time, instead of swinging his arm in defense, Ken begins to laugh. "Wait a minute. This horse is not out to threaten me. Yes, he thinks he's a big shot. He's a bit of an asshole, but actually, no, he's a clown. Look at him." Everyone laughs as Buddy calms down, prances around, nodding his head, showing off like a kid who's run away from his mom but does a cartwheel to charm her anyway. "This horse is in love with his own body," Ken says, and we all silently agree as Buddy glides by like a dancer. Ken approaches Buddy again, this time striding toward him and backing up, just like a dancer himself. Snaps the whip not to hit or scare Buddy, but to get his attention. Buddy comes to a full stop, his tracks making an 11 in the dust. It's a lot about pressure, Ken says to me. Actually, the release of pressure. Horses learn not from the pressure itself, but the absence of it. That's how they talk. There's an invisible pocket of energy between you and your horse. When you release it, it's a reward. When you give clear intention with it, it has meaning and power. Horses are always looking for that safety. Someone has chased him around. Did you see the way he responded to my tiny pressure before? My neighbor Fred had told me Buddy was saved from an exotic animal farm where he was confined knee-deep in manure before he ended up with a local woman, and then my neighbor Fred. Buddy follows Ken like a puppy. When Ken stops walking, Buddy stops too. I marvel. No bridle, no halter, just two guys taking a stroll. Catching a horse, nipping, problems with a bit, head tossing, they're all the same, really, Ken tells us. Once you get right with the horse, when you address the fear, the confusion, or the past, and provide strong, calm leadership, these things will disappear. Ken turns to me, what you don't know about yourself, your horse will show you. If you're impatient, he'll be afraid. If you're not focused and clear, he'll reflect your distraction. Ken wiggles his index finger in the air, and Buddy moves back another step. Buddy will be more comfortable and less naughty when you are clear about your own intention. And, by the way, Ken says, you're not a scratching post. I saw him with you over at the gate watching the other lessons. Ken must have eyes in the back of his head. When you rode in this morning, I knew you two were a unit. You clearly have a connection with this horse. I reach out and touch Buddy's neck as if to confirm what Ken is saying. Buddy has a way of making bad things shrink and disappear. But when you were standing by the gate earlier, I saw some disrespect. Were you aware of that? Ken takes the bridle from the fence post, puts it on Buddy, rubs his forehead. Buddy blinks, obedient and relaxed. It isn't good for you or for Buddy to allow him to do that. He needs the solid assurance that you respect yourself. Ken's words stir something deep inside me. They are true about Buddy, with whom I am deeply smitten, but they also resonate with what had happened years before when I was blown from one life into another, which in turn had brought me to this very afternoon. Like Buddy, I'd seen my share of wild relationships, both human and animal, and I too had lost my head a few times. Maybe that's why I felt such a kinship with this horse. Ken's lesson revealed that Buddy and I were actually afraid of the same things. Death, entrapment, being misunderstood, and mistreated, yes. But there was something else. Ken hands me Buddy's reins. I mean, would you want a person to come up and do that to you? Push you around? Invade your space? Would you stand there and take it just because he loved you?
I think it's fascinating the relationship that is drawn upon in the training of Buddy. And I think about also the bad boyfriend from New Mexico and his relationship with falcons.
Mm-hmm.
And that went another way.
Yes.
Because I know that falconers are trained also to commune with their animal. As mm-hmm. as dressage training with the horse. So I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, they can teach us so much.
Absolutely.
The animals. And they've been here so long and have, in their DNA, have accommodated so much in order to survive.
That's right.
And there's so much language in the animals. And now we're discovering even in the plants.
Right, right. Obviously, Buddy is a huge part of your life, but your memoir covers so much more. How did you choose what to put in and what not to put in?
Well, that's such an excellent question, because that's always hard, isn't it?
I mean, what
I think we all, when we're telling a story, you know, whether it's about, you know, our childhood or whether it's about what happened last week, there's always things we leave out.
Right.
And sometimes, like, for example, there are a few of my very, very close friends that aren't even in this memoir. And it's not because I don't adore them and that they're huge in my life. They just, it's always a matter of serving the story.
Right.
I cut lots and lots and lots of the book so that the momentum could go forward. And what's fun for me, because as you know, I'm a poet, I mm-hmm. really love putting disparate things in the same poem, or often my prompts for my students. I did this actually at San Juan College when I taught some workshops there when I lived in Taos.
Mm-hmm.
And also, actually, I was the poet in residence in Blanco for the kids one time. And, you know, so I feel like, anyway, the prompts I often offer children as well as adults is, you know, put three things in a poem and see how they clack against each other. You know, a wrench, a bag of M&Ms, and, you know, the color of your dog's hair. And so it really, for me, I think the book, because there are so many different threads, it really helps to clack them together.
Uh-huh.
And geography is one of those things, the land. And
right.
And my living in New Mexico deeply affected my life, always will, still haunts me. And maybe I'll read a little bit of when I introduce my first, because as you know, the memoir flips back and forth in time, but mm-hmm. my time in New Mexico actually was kind of the launching for this narrative.
Oh.
I didn't write it there, but I mean, it was like, okay, how do I resolve this?
Right.
And so I think the landscapes of the memoir are as crucial to me as the characters.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I'll just read a little passage from that chapter just a little bit further, called The Rope Trail.
Great.
And my friend Juan, who was a fly fisherman friend. I learned how to fly fish when I lived in Taos, and I became obsessed, absolutely obsessed with it, and the rivers, and lived on the Rio Hondo. And anyway, so I'll just read this a little bit about that.
Oh, good.
And also the dangers of of, you know, living so close to nature,
right.
too. When you look back at chapters in your life, there are certain moments that stand out as prescient, symbolic. It isn't until later, when you've risen above the chaos, that you see a larger symmetry unfolding. Even now, long after leaving that ravishing New Mexico sky, I returned to a September day. I went fishing with my friend Juan. The aspens stippled gold across the Sangre de Cristos, and the sky was a deep cerulean blue. Juan, a novelist, was at least a decade older and an experienced fisherman. It was always an honor to fish with him. That afternoon, we drove several miles out to the very edge of the vast canyon. He said he wanted to show me the rope trail, named for its near vertical drop from the mesa to the gushing Rio Grande below. The path, hidden from the casual observer, isn't far from the bridge that spans the gorge. When you drive across the mesa, the bridge, a dizzying 650 feet above the white water, is only visible right before you cross. In an instant, the earth falls away and you are flying over the canyon, its sheer rock cliffs plummeting to the river carving through the fissure. A river guide friend had told me about a cougar who'd attempted to cross that bridge one night. When the cat got to the middle of the trestle, an oncoming car blinded him so completely that in one clean leap he cleared the guardrail, headlights catching only his disappearing tail. My friend had found the body not far from where Juan and I were headed. "This way," Juan hollered as I slammed the truck door. We slipped and skidded down the rocky trail, Juan's red bandana fluttering. I followed his lead. As we descended around giant boulders, he pointed out a red-tailed hawk nest tucked in the crevices. White dung splattered over the rocks like Anasazi petroglyphs. Bones of small mammals lay scattered around the nest. The merciless sun glared, and I was careful to keep from pitching downward toward the river below. Juan scrambled on, pointing to the ravens circling above us on a thermal, their guttural cries echoing off the canyon walls. As we descended, sending a flush of pebbles ahead, we hung to scrub pine and sagebrush, clutching our rod cases, sometimes using them as walking sticks to break a possible fall. When we reached the bottom, the cool river air soothed our faces. We sat on a big rock, put up our rods, and tied on some flies. I played it safe and pulled out a woolly bugger, but Juan tied a complicated double drop with a nymph on one tippet and elk hair caddis on the other. We began our ritual of leapfrogging. He fished a section, I fished a section, and then when one of us finished, we veered around the other. We worked our way upstream toward the arc of the bridge. It was strange how fishing awakened the desire for my own spawning. The men I'd been involved with in Riojos had not worked out, however. One had died swiftly and unexpectedly from lung cancer. The other was no longer able to have children. I'd been hopeful for each of these romances. The shock, grief, and disappointment just drove me more deeply into the rivers. The fragrance of cottonwoods, the sound of water over stone. And each time I cast my fly into the current, I think I was also casting for a lasting mate. The life-giving force of fishing, however, seemed paradoxical to that moment when a trout flops on the line. After all, predator behavior was new to me. As I'd learned to fish, I also learned that each delicate slip of the line tied me closer to an ancient survival ritual. And each time I felt the rush of a trout on the line and the smatter in the water, I was startled by the unfamiliar elation washing through my body, as though there were something necessary about the swift violence, the death. Juan and I fished upstream, leapfrogging toward the bridge, its trusses arching high above us like flying buttresses. I cast over out over the ripples, and soon I felt that thrilling bump on the line. A silver shower scattered the air as the trout fought and splashed. I set the hook and landed in near the bank. I blessed the fish over and over again, trying not to drop him in the sand. I blessed him partly to calm myself, partly because I was still not accustomed to the glittery package of life when I finally received it. I breathed in and out, mouthing a grace, smacked its head against a rock and gently laid it on the fresh grass in my creel. A practice I'd learned from a friend at the Pueblo. I stood up trembly and dazed, as if I'd just made love. I tied on a hopper and slowly cast upstream, but just as a cutthroat rose to my fly, a sound like dynamite exploded in the middle of the river. I drew back as the bursting plashed echoed off the canyon walls. In a split second, Juan yelled, "Run!" and then, "Cover your head!" My animal instincts were already moving my body toward the shadow of the bridge. I followed Juan as fast as I could over the slippery rocks, the fly on my line looping in the air like penmanship.
I'm so glad you read that part. It's gorgeous. And it just depicts the area so much. I love that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So before Wild Ride Home, you did publish a poetry book that fall.
Mm-hmm.
You're really a poet at heart, but your prose...
I've been writing poems for, my adult life mostly, and publishing, and, most of my readings were with poems and everything, but another cool thing that happened when I lived in New Mexico is that I was an art writer for a magazine in Santa Fe.
Oh.
And I took to writing more and more prose then, because every month I had to turn in four art reviews for Santa Fe and Taos and the surrounding area. And if I traveled, I would review a show at a museum in New York or whatever. And that taught me a lot about not just writing prose, which I did anyway, but it was sort of legitimized it for me. And
right.
It taught me about deadlines. And
right.
It was really a great teacher for me. It taught me how to see differently, and it helped me with my aesthetic as an artist, I think, a
mm-hmm.
writer.
Did you keep a journal and then use that to inform the memoir, or did you just sit down and write the memoir from the seat of the pants?
That's a good question. Some of it I did go back and look at journals, yes, and actually did some fact-checking, on that also with people. But also, especially after I came back to the Northwest, which happens in this book. You know I'm in the Northwest because the first chapter of Buddy, I won't be giving anything away.
Right.
I did keep pretty accurate journals, and especially during my mother's Alzheimer's,
mm-hmm.
I realized that that needed to be recorded in some way. It was too powerful not to record it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had notebooks of stuff that she'd say and things like that. And also with Ken, actually those lessons I wrote, I kept a little scrap of paper in my pocket because as you could tell, he's so eloquent. And I did write a lot of that down. But not all of it, of course.
Right,
I mean,
right.
My childhood memories are very emblazoned in my memory.
Right.
And my siblings have read it, so I got a few fact-checking from them. But that's a good question, because you know, you think, well, how do you remember all that stuff?
Right.
Well, when you write stuff down, even in notes, it stays in your brain. It's like a
yes.
physical act of writing something.
Right. Now, you also lead workshops and give presentations on writing and are a writing coach.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I love my teaching, always have. I have always sort of worked on my own and made my own way in the world. I've never had a permanent teaching job since I was a high school teacher years ago,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, is the most wonderful thing about Facebook. I know there are many bad things.
Right.
You know, all my old students, you know, many, many, many are on Facebook and have bought the book and have reviewed it and have, you know, these are when I was just young, you know, when I was in my 20s even, which is so fun. So I love my teaching. I was a high school teacher in New Hampshire and then taught in England for a while, too. But my teaching now is at Hugo House in Seattle,
mm-hmm.
where I teach weekend courses at the Literary Center there and the University of Iowa Summer Writing Festival, which I've done since 2004 and just love that community. And yes, I'm a private coach too. It's really wonderful. I have clients that I talk to one-on-one. Often they have been students or participants, and then we work on projects, and it's really a beautiful thing to be able to do to help someone find his or her voice.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so I'm working on things now. I've got a little book about Buddy with photographs I'm working on,
oh.
and more poems. I've got more poems going, and I have things brewing for another nonfiction book, but I'm keeping that under my hat until I figure out some things.
Yeah, I get that. I understand that.
You have to let them brew, you know? You have to
yes,
let them brew.
Yes, absolutely. Listeners can find information, more information about you on your website, ChristineHemp.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful
Absolutely.
Website. All kinds of information there.
Oh, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
I did it myself. I really love the art project. Yeah, I love the art project of it.
Yes.
I love getting the photographs and putting them together it's just yet another art project. I gave a talk at Iowa last summer called The Writing Life,
mm-hmm.
but I crossed out the word writing and as the title, you know, so
mm-hmm.
it sort of strike through, and it's called, in other words, it's the life. And I think if I had
oh.
any advice to give to writers, it's our whole life we incorporate into our work, and that...
Yeah.
That all the passions we have, like, you know, whatever it is, gardening or art or, you know, horses or
right.
dogs
right.
or, you know, spinning or whatever it is, spinning wool. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think we're so specialized in our culture that unless we tap into all the passions of our life, we really, we're cutting off ourselves as writers and storytellers. And I say that only because I love the teaching I do. I, you know, find that my life here on the Strait of Juan de Fuca is just so rich that it isn't, a person isn't just a writer. A person has a whole life.
We can read all about that, about your personal life and about you and get to know you so well.
Well, it's just been lovely talking to you, Tracy, but lovely questions, and it's really kind of a a touching thing for me to be able to touch back to New Mexico through you and San Juan College and that part of the state that I love as well. My good friend Vicki Holmston lived there when I was in Taos, and I love your part of, you know, I love that Four Corners too. So I really appreciate your asking me to be on your show.
So I look forward to more.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Tracy.
Thank you. And that was Christine Hemp talking about her memoir, Wild Ride Home, Love, Loss, and a Little White Horse. This is Tracy Hales-Fass with Ride on Four Corners.